tonight we have Ambrose Thompson from Martin Audio. Ambrose Thompson received his engineering degree in electroacoustics from the University of Salford in 96, after which he worked as an acoustics engineer in the hi-fi industry, where he designed loudspeakers, systems and drive units. In 2001, Ambrose joined Martin Audio Limited as a loudspeaker design engineer and developed interest in the application of the boundary element method into horn and loudspeaker system simulation. Recently, he has been investigating the use of numerical optimization for loudspeaker component and system design. So thank you very much. Ambrose, over to you.
Okay, thank you very much. Hello. That's our title, Improved Methods for Controlling Touring Loudspeakers. This was a paper that we did at the AES last time, but I've added to this with some sort of supporting bits around it. So here's our kind of content. So we'll go through like a definition of what we mean by touring array loudspeaker. Data, which really is more about the model than the data, but and then we go into the, how we control these things and how users design them, not how we design them. And then we look at our work with optimization and then finally how to implement it. And we provide some examples. Yes, of course. Okay, well, you know, you missed all that, but never mind. Nowadays, there seems to be this choice in Turing array loudspeakers between the one on the left and the one on the right. And this rather simplistic view of the Turing array scene kind of blinds us, really, to the fact that they're quite similar things. So embodiments of these line arrays and, let's say, point source arrays are these. If we move on, this is 1973 when I was born. This is Earls Court in Pink Floyd. And if you study this photo quite carefully, you might detect a sort of linear trend in some of the devices there. And this is, of course, before they discovered mid-range. So it's mostly bass and top. A bit later on, they discovered mid-range, and then they also discovered how to fill an entire stage with PA. Again, a close examination will reveal quite a linear trend in some of these sources. And an interesting thing about this system, apart from its enormous bloody size, is that each instrument, or each sort of group of instruments, were put through different sections. So, you know, you'd have three sort of main sections there, or three or four main sections, and guitars and drums and things would come through different bits of the system. Now, I would dearly love to have heard that, but I don't think we'll see that again for a while. Moving forward, we've really truly discovered mid-range by now. These are long-throw elements in a point-source array speaker. So those two boxes at the top, long throw elements, and again you see this sort of linear trend. So really what I'm trying to get across is that, you know, the point source line array, it's not so clear cut. So right, move on to the data. This was culled from a paper that we did with friends at Ease about how to more accurately model array sources. So the first thing we really have to do is measure something. Measure something as a whole, not just little bits of it. So we started with a little baby line array, which we make. And we chose it because it's small and it's light. So if we can't really get 1 ton of loudspeaker and revolve it about its central axis very accurately anyway. So, but we can do it very accurately with this. So this is essentially what we did. We've got this array, and we twisted it round in the plane that you're looking in. So central to the theme of some of the ideas is this one of superposition, which if you obey it, pretty much works. not so much superstition, which doesn't tend to work very well for loudspeaker data. So what do we mean really by this superposition thing? Well, this is a balloon about 2 kilohertz or so, and it's just the top box of this linear array. But the thing to note here is that this linear array is present during the acquisition of this data. And this is a BEM model, actually, so it's not actually measured, but you can't really tell the difference most of the time. So the first thing to note about that is it's not symmetrical. So you're getting sort of support from essentially things near it, which is no great surprise, really. Then it gets slightly more symmetrical as we come down. So remember, this is just the red box active being rotated about the red box's central axis. And then by the time we get down to the third box, we are seeing some sort of more symmetry. And what we do is we sort of have an average of the ones in the middle. So we take one of the middle boxes and we use that for the rest of the boxes above and below in that region. And to get the whole set, we just have to flip the ones at the top. Now, this data is then used in the... I think Stefan gave it another name, a complex directional point source model. but it's essentially the model that everyone uses, Ease and whoever else, because it's fast. It's not to say it's the best model, there are probably other ones, but this is the one we use. So we'll label that as positional data. Another type of data that we could use with this point source model is one where we just have the two neighbours, one above, one below. And then we get a symmetrical kind of response, as we'd expect. But it's kind of different to what we had before. We'll label that flanked data. And then the most basic one is isolated data, so you just have one box. And this is typically, I say typically because I don't know, but I think that's what most people use. So there's the results. you can squint at that if you want, but what we'll do with this is we'll just concentrate on this 40 degree opening angle away from the speaker, because this is where most of the action happens. This is kind of like the coverage region. So if we plot the error in dB, its frequency and angle in that fixed angle, blue is good, red is bad. And this is for the positional data, so it's pretty good. So we're looking at 1 to 1.5 or something of that order between our measured data and our predicted data. Flanked data is still quite good, but it's not quite as good as positional data. And, well, isolated data, it's no hope at 400 to 600 hertz, so you have some serious problems there. So to kind of compare these all together, so we sort of scrunch them up and take an average, these are the three sort of indicators, really. That's all you can say about is an indication of the error between the three different types of data. And there's a winner in there somewhere. So we use positional data for these reasons. So, uniformity. The assumption in all of these models is that every speaker is absolutely identical, which it isn't. So we did some more work with our friend at Ease about how this may affect the performance. So this is the SPL variation of the array that you saw earlier. And I have to note that it is pretty appalling in certain regions, and that's because I built it personally with missing out some gaskets and various things, bad things. Anyway, it's a good example for this. And here's the phase uniformity. So if we choose a particularly nasty frequency where things are going wrong, 2.5 kilohertz, for instance, and we'll look at the difference between the measured and the flanked data. Now, if we apply a correction just based on the axial kind of difference, then the data falls into line. So basically this means if you get the on-axis pressure of the thing and then correct it all up, it will work around as well, so it's not sort of angle-dependent. Far field, does it work in the far field? Well, yes. So we just take this data and we do it at different distances, and if we look at them all, they're all pretty much the same. This is BEM data as well. Okay, so this is yet another thing about the support of local cabinets and how really you should be sensitive to measurements of data. This is a bigger system. This is sort of a mid-range device, sort of sliced in half. And the plane that you see is essentially where the grills would be in a six-box array. And you see a sort of distribution of pressure on this imaginary surface. And if we put the rest of the boxes around it on that same surface at 400 hertz, remember we've not turned the other boxes on, just put them there, then it's quite different. And I don't think we should really be surprised by any of this. It's you know, you can hear it. You put some one thing next to another thing, it changes something. So, control. So we'll go through the kind of control that people have used already to control line arrays for live sound. And the most basic one is shape, and that's controlled by changing the display angles. So you can shape your array differently to achieve different goals in the audience area. EQ. Currently, this is just global EQ. This is just like input EQ. So you feed this equalization to each box. And then this thing that we call band zoning. But essentially, it splits the array up into different sections for EQ. So high frequencies, we split it into 3 bits. Middle frequencies, 2 bits. And LF, 1 bit. And the reason we did that was in many instances we weren't having enough projection to overcome air absorption with the shape alone. If you wanted to really boost your high frequencies to a great distance, then you would need quite a flat section at the top. And more often than not, people can't afford that many boxes. So it's a way of using some sensitivity just to push some high frequencies forward. It also allows for a better tailoring of the output to the audience. And there's another reason why we did it that way, is because at the time all we had was that blue box, which is an excellent blue box, by the way, but it only had 6 channels on it. So that's why it's 6. So now we move on to the design, and this is not the design of the bits and pieces inside the box. This is the sound engineer at a gig, how he would design his system. So rules. This is rules about shape generally. He may favour spacing the intercepts of these rays that hits the audience. You may want to have some sort of rule about the spacing between these intercepts. You may want to have a rule about a shape, like a progressive curvature or an even curvature or a J shape or whatever else, really. So you can kind of encode these rules into very easy to use software. And what we found is that spirals or progressive curvature arrays work quite nicely. So we made a little tool to encode that little rule. Next is trial and error and human. So this is a very time-consuming activity. So the We use our CDPS model, the point source model, and we show the user what he'll get if he arranges the speakers with a particular EQ in the venue. And from that, the chap who's doing the design will change something, have a look at it, change something, have a look at it, and on and on and on. And that takes quite some time. We can't discourage many of our customers from using that, which has surprisingly produced some good results. Right, optimization, which is the meat of this. We've been doing some work on optimization and various things. First of all, we automated the display angle, so we don't use rules really very much anymore. We just have the display angle, the shape of the array is determined by an optimization process. That was the first kind of step. And then there's the step of including EQ into that. So we included the global EQ. So we'd give the customer a house curve target, and it would just simply take one channel of parametrics and whatever else he wanted to throw in there and make it like house curve. So we combine these things already into a software application. And this is for a very small binary, like the one we measured. And it's a nice sort of modern interface, looks quite pretty. but it enables the user to get access to these kind of hopefully useful automation features. And the new thing, the one that we've just put into this, is EEQ, and for want of a better word, is elemental EQ. It's probably a very bad name, and probably get changed immediately by anyone in marketing. But the reason why we did this elemental EQ is because we're being asked from our customers a series of sometimes unreasonable things. But amongst them, these are probably quite reasonable. They want sort of a consistent coverage. And what we mean by that is just an even frequency response, just a nice frequency response from one place to another place. It doesn't really want it to change rapidly. Reduced leakage. This is more about kind of focusing the sound into the audience rather than having it going on the roof or the walls or wherever else. They want to be able to change the coverage as well. So they might want, in some cases, to extend it a bit or pull it back a bit in this near region. And we should add they want to do this electronically. So once the display angles are set for a gig, there's no hope of going and changing them. They're set forever, that's it. And they want it done in 20 minutes. Now, this might seem unreasonable, but it's thoroughly reasonable when you consider the kind of typical day loading in and dealing with a live sound rig. Now, excuse the diagram. So here we are, 9 o'clock in the morning, load in, stage, audience area. So at this point, there'll be a less enormous truck piling in speakers, lighting equipment, all the instruments, flight cases, everywhere. And then by 10 a.m, the points have to be defined, and these are the bits that stuff gets flown off. And it's mostly lights, I must say. But you have to, in that period, know where you're going to put your speakers, and you have to have some good idea about what shape they're going to be as well. So this is where the 20 minutes thing comes in. So in that sort of slot, you've got to measure your venue, acquire that data, you put it into some software, whether it be the simple rule-based software or something more sophisticated, and decide where you're going to put your speakers physically, and decide what angles they're going to be, and then, you know, write that down. So then lighting starts to go up. So, and then the arrays and more lighting goes up. And then the subs go in, and the task there is just to put the subs where they fit and then align them to the main system. And that's generally done through some measurement. More lighting. Did I mention the lighting? The stage monitor people come along and they beaver about with their own strangeness. And then finally some instruments get shoved in on top of all this chaos. It's not chaos, actually. It's quite organised. But you have to get to this stage very quickly. And often a 9 a.m. load-in is quite luxurious. Sometimes it's a lot less. So sound checks at 3. This was a gig we did recently with the new system. And you can see the... well, you can't see the speakers, which is what they want. But you can see the lights. Very pretty lights, actually. So they come along and they twang about for an hour or two. And then the support acts come along and they twang about for half an hour. And then the doors open. And there's lights, more lights. I've put some M's where the speakers begin. So there's these mysterious little linear black things up there. So that goes on, this incredible noise and assault on the senses happens for 3 or 4 hours, and then it all just gets thrown back in the truck. And then the next day, do it again and again. So the last thing that audio engineers responsible for putting these things on want is complexity. It's just, they will not thank you for it. So some examples. So there's a couple of examples. The first one is this one. This is the same boxes as used in that one with the pretty lights. So we've got in this box, in each box, we've separated out each source. So each source has its own amplifier and its own EQ. So you have lots of channels. Now, that's a really appalling, nasty little venue. It's the Martin Audio factory floor. Tin shed, I think, often polluted by lots of people building speakers and making a noise. But that's that was our first testing ground. So it's about 35 metres total. And if we, each one of these little red dots, that's sort of an imaginary microphone position. This is where we sort of sample the field. And if we EQ, each box is a sort of default setting to be flat, well, not quite flat, but ramped up slightly, like a 12 dB ramp, but smooth. So that if you measured one box by itself, that's what you get. And when you put them all together in this shape, that's what you get at various points in the audience. Now, it's not quite... It's quite hard, really, to make out what the hell's going on there. You can see a sort of general trend. It looks pinkish. That's all you can say about it, really. So if we now kind of get all those frequency responses and plot them out in a kind of surface, so we have frequency against position. It becomes actually much easier to see what's going on, but it's not immediately apparent how this kind of plot works. So we go through it a bit. So the audience area is this sort of strip in the middle. So at the positions that start from that little triangle on the left to that triangle on the right, those position indices, the frequency response is plotted on this sort of surface plot thing. And then we can start to identify other areas of this this fantastic menu. This is the rear wall, and we can see immediately that there's really not much high frequencies being projected at that. There's the roof. You can see some aliasing going on there. Behind it, again, it's nice and quiet, which is good. And, well, the stage, which is actually a rack full of cardboard, I think. So, I think it's probably worth just going through that again, just to sort of try and remind yourself of what would be a good response in there. A good response would be one colour, maybe. If that was, if you wanted the same sound or the same level everywhere, which you probably wouldn't want, but we'll come on to. So now we've got control of these 48 channels, we need to introduce an objective function in order to kind of optimize this system. And optimization is an enormous, huge, frightening area. So we're happy to use MATLAB to do this for us. But you still need to generate some objective functions, and we'll look at some of the objectives in isolation. So we've done one for smoothness, and that could be smoothness of the pressure with respect to frequency or position. Profile, which is a sort of how loud one part is relative to the mix position. So we always define the mix position. This is where all the engineers camp, and then you can say you can say at the front you want it 2 dB louder than where I'm standing now, and at the back I want it 2 dB quieter, or any other kind of profile of level. Leakage is a fairly obvious one, and almost a trivial one is just a single number, a target. I want X dB in this area. So, going back to our funny plot, so the grayed out one is where we started off, and the top one is sort of smooth, so it's just the smooth objective function doing its work. And we can see it's kind of extruded the response along the frequency axis from its start point. We made no special attempt to start it with anything special distribution. It just started. So what it's tried to do is it's tried to make the frequency response as flat and as smooth as possible. And it's had a reasonable go at that over quite a wide range of frequencies. And even in the areas where it's not quite so smooth, it's quite an improvement over what was there before. Leakage. Well, if you remember that bit just above the main audience area was sort of the roof and back wall and all the rest of it. And blue, there's much, much bluer in that area. And it hasn't really changed the character of what's going on within the audience area. So it's just sucked out some energy that was heading off for bits you don't really want it to go to. Element EQ profile. So this is saying I'm standing at mixed position and I want the level to be exactly the same at the front as the back. So that's 30 metres. So if I'm standing at the 15 metre mark, at 0 metres I want the same level, and at 30 metres I want the same level. So this it turns out to be an extrusion almost along the position. It's not a very wise thing to do that, really, because it sounds very strange. You're walking up to a speaker and it's just getting no louder, and you're walking away from the speaker and it's getting no quieter. It's quite disconcerting. Another view of this is frequency response. It might be quite useful in this instance. We can see how far away we are from these things all being exactly the same. Again, we've made no special attempt to give it a particular shape. It's just scrunching things together. A more useful one, much more useful one, if you specify this plus minus 2 profile. So you're saying, well, did 2 dB louder at the front, 2 dB quieter at the back. And that sounds natural, more natural. And again, it's had a pretty good go doing that. So we see that when we look at the frequency responses now, they kind of fit within a nice sort of tight region. And that's the kind of trivial, I want X dB in this entire area. Of course, you know, it's not as brilliant as it is sort of 8,000 hertz and above. The radiation is quite different. You know, this thing violates a lot of things. You can't really steer these things. They're not really closely spaced, but you still have control. You still have enough control to do pretty much what you want. So the real utility with these things comes when you start combining the different objectives. And if you use a multi-objective optimizer, where you can not just an aggregate, not just a sort of weighting, but you actually have, you read in MATLAB, you'll find them out, but there's proper objective functions which are multi-valued, or you know, I can explain later maybe. So we can combine these things, and we can see that, you know, when we want something else generally always has to suffer. So in the top one, we've got a nice profile, i.e. we've got a nice sort of change of level, and we've got a nice amount of smoothness. But we may be worried about the amount of pressure going off to bits that we don't want, so we turn up the leakage effect, and then that has an impact on our profile and our smoothness in that region where it's taking most out. But this is a choice, really. You can give the leakage less influence, so it's sort of a continuum somewhere between these values. In some circumstances, you really may want to have pull out as much energy as you possibly can. So if you have a stage and you have speakers above the stage, sometimes it's really important not to put stuff on the stage, and you're prepared to suffer whatever happens in the audience for that reason. Now this is getting onto the sort of more advanced coverage manipulations. You can pull the array back, so you can pull the coverage back by 7 meters or a bit more. And this has not really been totally worked through, but in theory it's there. We've just applied a different profile. And you can make it work a little bit in the other direction as well. So this array was different now. We've made it sort of concentrate its energy just by splaying into that sort of denser region of red. And what we'd like to do is to sort of extend it a little bit forward, which we can do. This is another interesting one, which sounds really strange, like really properly strange, is to choose a bit of the audience area where you say, I want it a bit less loud there, across all frequencies. So it's like walking into a bit of a mist or a null. It's not as if it gets quiet, but you just, you go from a direct sound to a sort of reverberant sound and then back into a direct sound again. It's quite strange. So this is all wonderful, but only if we can make it work. So the issue that we face is that this model space, this ideal space that we've been, you know, dealing with, it manipulates the magnitude of the phase for each element at every frequency. So later I'll probably show you one of these optimizations in progress, and you can see how that kind of pans out. But in reality, unfortunately, or fortunately, we have to put it inside these things, and these things have limitations. So FOR filters are what we use, obviously. And we use a fairly trivial way of getting to those FOR filters from model space. But if we ignore the limitations of the FOR filters, we get some funny results. So now these three sections, HF, mid and bottom, the HF's got many more devices, of course, because it's three per box, and it's kind of arranged. So the box one's at the top in each one of these plots. So you have magnitude and phase. And what you'll notice is magnitude looks quite sensible, but the phase really doesn't. So if you were to try and implement this, you'd end up with some problems. Through the midband and far field, it seems to work quite nicely. But down in here, we get these transition nulls, these phase transition nulls. What we're asking of a filter is to swap phase quite abruptly with frequency, because we don't care what, you know, we implement. And whenever you do that, you always get a sort of null, because it has to go through a null to get there. And even if you pump up the resolution, it will still be there. So if we include some of these limitations, and this comes down to putting a constraint on how the model space changes with frequency, not with position up and down the array, but just with frequency. So we're just asking for smooth functions or smoother functions. So now we see things are a bit different. We can see that the phase is relatively smoothly changing, and so is the magnitude. And finally, our result. Now, this slightly light bar is a mistake I made with the crossover, so try and ignore that. But really, what I want to highlight is we really don't have anywhere near as many of these nasty dropouts and phase transition models. So we've taken some limitations about how we can make the filters back into the world of the imaginary world of a perfect world. So you might ask, why on earth would you want to split it up? Why don't you just operate on the filters in the first place and its speed? This thing on the left, we can get to the most perfect ideal thing in minutes, literally minutes, and the implementation can take a lot less than minutes. But if we were operating on the FIR filters, we'd have to calculate a sort of transverse response every time, and it's hours, not minutes. A bonus. If you use the FIR filters, you get these rather tasty crossovers that you can do. The top one is the sort of transfer functions that we use, and the bottom one is then coupled with a measured output. One of them is an FIR filter, the other one isn't. You also get lots of pretty lights to look at, which is always a bonus. This is from that gig with the nice lights. There are nice lights. And we can see the levels going into each source. So each of these sources, we can see. If you look very carefully, you can see that this is arranged: the box one at the top, box 10 at the bottom. The HF levels going in at the bottom of the array quite a lot less, and the HF levels at the top of the array quite a bit more. But interestingly, not the top box. So the second box is louder than the top box. Interesting. Right, so need to kind of show that this might work, prove it. Here's some measured data of our start point. This is just like, you know, flat out speaker, no processing at all, apart from the crossovers and the ramp. And that's what we measure in this area. If we apply this 2 dB profile, you can measure these things, and it's kind of, it's doing pretty much what we ask. It's constraining all of these frequency responses within a window, and it's producing a fairly nice level flat frequency response. Another effort. This is one of our more adventurous customers. We were chatting to him about these techniques, Glenn Leanbrookham. And he said, oh, I want to try that in an Australian accent. And we said, fine. So he did this with the little baby Omniline speakers. And his venue had a sort of balcony front. You see, it's glass. So you have this horrible reflective specular glass thing pointing straight at a speaker. So we, apologies for the resolution, so we put one of these kind of mist things in, and he said that sounded excellent, but he also measured it as well. These are the responses he got, not just sort of in a line either, but on the top left you'll see little bits of tape on the floor, and he kind of measured it all around this venue and generated these rather nice frequency response plots. Again, this is using elemental EQ just on a box level. So Glenn got hold of 10 of our speakers and 10 amplifiers and 10 channels of someone else's processing, and we gave him some FIR filters, and he managed to make it all work. That's great. That's it. And I think the only thing really to kind of comment on is what we need to do next. And the low frequencies, you know, we need to have a look at how to deal with them more precisely. And I think we need to look at some more analytical methods of arriving at this answer. In many ways, optimization or numerical optimization is cheating. And even though it's cheating, it has produced some excellent results. But I think there may be an underlying analytical, mathematical way to come to the same answer, probably more quickly and probably slightly better. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ambrose. I think we have plenty of time for questions. If anybody would like to ask a question, please raise your hand and speak clearly into the microphone.
Al Walker, Midas Clark Technic. I noticed your frequency plot's going down to 200 hertz.
That's right.
Is that a function of the limitation of the FIR filters and propagation delay?
Well, it's a function that we only have FIR filters on our mid and HF.
So right, for the reason,
the
yeah.
Base, you know, what can you do with an FIR filter?
True.
You need an enormous one. Mm. And we're quite concerned about the length of our FIR filters. There was some recent work in the US about what quite long filters might sound like. So we've taken that into account and we've kept them quite compact. They're no bigger than they really need to be. Of course, I'd love some more resolution, but I don't think it would sound very nice. And two, the firmware guys have just said a flat no. So, you know, we have to...
Yeah, I've encountered that as well.
Yeah, yeah.
Any questions?
Ambrose, what do the equalization curves end up looking like? So the corrections that you would send to a particular module, do you allow sharp variations or do you try and keep them very smooth?
We keep them. This is the point about including the limitations of our FIR filters and their length within a kind of perfect world. So we constrain its smoothness with frequency in both mode tuning phase, but we don't make any description about how it should change with box. So things between different boxes, things could have quite different levels between different elements in the same box. They could have different levels and different amounts of the phase nudging. So this is somewhat different to the sort of simple view of line arrays emitting this coherent, you know, wavefront. But yes, we do. We do impose on smoothness.
Thank you.
What I can also do, actually, is I can show you that rather pretty diagram of the lights. I can show you the process that we went through to calculate that. So I've got this set up on my PC here. So if anyone's interested, we could show like an optimization, you know, just working and generating some numbers and whatever else. And this is the program that we used to do the EQ for this last gig. And I think the last time I did this, I had, I don't know, 130 dB of 40 hertz hitting the back of my head, so it should be a bit easier.
So if I understood properly, you are doing the computation for the optimization frequency per frequency, is that correct?
That's right.
But when you're talking about this, it was very interesting the fact that you try to keep the phase variation smooth.
Yes.
So would that correspond to imposing that the next frequency calculation is somehow related to the previous?
You can try feeding stuff back in, and I have tried that, where your starting point is, your next starting point is where you left off before. That seems to work quite nicely over certain bands. But because of the way that the radiation changes, there are very distinct points where it will change. So you've got to go from mid to HF. There's an enormous change of radiation there. You go from two mid drivers, quite widely spaced, to 3 HFs all quite tightly spaced. And then even within the band of one device, you start having sort of different types of radiation. You know, you go from a sort of nice kind of steerable type system where everything's all nice and close together and fantastic compared to the wavelength, to something where, you know, the source is actually quite big and the space widely apart. So I think it works quite nicely within limited bands, but you do have to kind of reset at some point to get the answer.
So that is the way that you kind of impose the smoothness condition in the phase, by imposing that the starting point of the next frequency should be related to this?
Well, we kind of... We set sort of limits from where it was before to where it will next be. But it's important to note that at crossover at 3,900 Hz, which is a nice crossover frequency, at crossover you have to start again. You can't use what was going on. And we kind of get away with it because the crossover is so steep and you can kind of tolerate this sort of big change in radiation.
So is that why there was a kind of white line in the...
No, that was me being lazy.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
The model I'm thinking of is that the loudspeakers that are flown are essentially passive and the amplifiers and driver electronics are separate, is that right?
No, it's all in one box, but, you know, you could put it all outside if you want big fat cables.
In your system, are the amplifiers inside the speaker box?
Yes, that's correct, yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. But in the, interestingly, in Glenn's little project array, he kept everything separate. I mean, boxes about that big, but it was big cables.
Do you find you get significant advantage by integrating the drive electronics in the speaker boxes?
Oh, for sure.
But you escape from that long speaker run.
That's always helpful. I mean, the guys installing these things are generally complimentary when they only have to shove power in the air, not power and a cable thing that thick sometimes, which weighs a ton, and of course you have to store it and fix it, and it can always go wrong.
Okay.
So, yeah.
Would you consider networking the audio into those boxes?
It's the only way you can do it properly, isn't it?
Yeah.
So, yes.
Thank you.
Okay.
Okay, any more questions?
I might have missed it, but regarding the work that you did with Stefan,
yeah.
You measured the radiation for a given configuration of the array. How do you think this measurement is robust when you start changing the relative angle between the units of the array? Do you think it's quite robust or changed dramatically?
I don't think it changes dramatically at all. What we did was we did various... You see, in those ones, we just had a straight line. And essentially, the difference in the region of frequencies that where this effect is most prevalent... there was not much change. There was a bit, I would say there was none, but there was not much change. It wasn't particularly significant in that area. Other areas, yes, but as the frequency rises, the sources is getting quite large and it kind of projects away from the thing, so the neighbour really doesn't matter. So you end up in this nice sort of geometric region where it's just like a horn being, you know, projecting away from its neighbours. So, yeah, it was something that we've looked at.
And it was not dramatic. As if I recall well, it was in the region of mid-low frequency where the
Definitely.
Effect of the scattering of the other
in fact,
units was...
There was a... in our first ever kind of acoustic model that we released to people in software, we had to put in a hidden EQ. And this EQ was there to... make the measurements that we made at various field trials and tests and wherever we're down again agree with what we measured, and this was the reason why we looked into it, because it's really annoying to have to put into your model something you can't explain. So, you know, it's essentially what happened.
Anybody else for questions? Or well, I think it remains me to thank you very much, Ambrose, for your talk. And you're going to be offering a demonstration here, are you, for those who are interested?
If anyone wants to just look at it, then they're quite welcome to.
Thank you. That sounds very interesting. So thank you very much to Ambrose.